He kind of started all the plants growing, and he started people. Well, I guess he's kind of big and fat.
He can see us whatever we do. Whatever we do, he has such powerful eyes. He doesn't have millions and thousands and billions. And he can still see us when we're bad.
He could be sitting on the table right now, but you can't see him.
He can't be everywhere at once doing everything for everybody. Everybody can't get what they want.
Welcome to the broadcast today, ladies and gentlemen. It is July 10th, Monday, and my name is David Stovenel. The website is genuinechristianitynow.com, and this is part three of a series about John Quincy Adams' Letters on Freemasonry. Now, what will transpire today is there will be an audio of the logical outworking of what happens when occultists, vicious, selfish occultists, gain a certain amount of power and control, and the logical outworking of that in today's America and the world today. As you can see, as things are unfolding, there is violence and turmoil in a lot of different areas of the world, and that does not exclude the states here in America. So anyway, what will be happening is that we have already described in the first two presentations about John Quincy Adams of his inspection about Freemasonry after the murder of Captain William Morgan, as he was writing letters inquiring among the leading lights within Freemasonry of the day in which he lived. So this is a fair warning that we have to spread and alert to others that instead of occultism, what we want is the light of Christ to shine on all corners of the earth. And anyway, for a reading in the scripture today, we'll go to Isaiah chapter 6. Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. Now, ladies and gentlemen, my website, genuinechristianitynow.com, has a word search bar on it. And for those of you listening by radio, or for that matter, by the internet as well, if you type in the words Fred Smart, Injustice Exposed, at another time than this broadcast, you can watch and see the documents that are displayed while this discussion is taking place, because what we are going into now in this third and final presentation about Freemasonry and occultism and that which is hidden, of how right in front of our very eyes, how these people that are so vicious and selfish and wicked can get away with murder, theft, deceit, identity theft, every type of manipulation that you can imagine. But when they are exposed, that is light shining on the darkness. So anyway, if you word search for Fred Smart, Injustice Exposed, and especially for veterans, and veterans, please do contact me, those of you that know and have proof that you have been discriminated against when applying for a civil service or for any other job, for that matter, in that your numbers in terms of testing scores or your work history or whatever the case may be was adequate to receive a position, and yet you were passed over and denied a position, and especially for those of you that were repeatedly denied a job when that was all you were looking for, a place in this society after a hard war. So please do go ahead with that, Mr. Broadcaster.
Welcome to Veterans Forum. I'm here, Fred Smart, from Chicago, Illinois, along with my co-host, Dr. Lee Warren. And our special guest tonight is Edwin Crosby III, who hails from Albion, New York. We're going to do three shows on this subject. We want to invite you into our living room. This is a subject that involves the systematic abuse, stealing and fraud of our veterans, their benefits, their jobs. And over the last 2.5-3 weeks, I was tipped off to this earlier last year. Here in Illinois, we've had a big uproar about veterans, the benefits coming to Illinois veterans being at the very bottom of the scale among the 50 states. This hit about 2.5-3 years ago, caused a huge uproar. In the last couple of months, we've had the Walter Reed Medical Hospital uproar about the deplorable conditions in Walter Reed, while at the very top we have these penthouses and these luxurious suites with oriental rugs and butlers. And we're here today to discuss something that goes down to at the bottom, at the core of the root of the systemic computerized processing of the computers, of the codes, of the system, of what makes the Veterans Affairs for Benefits run and hum nationwide. I was astounded when I learned about this. A gentleman out of the blue called me from downstate Illinois, and he said, "Fred, are you aware of this problem, aware of this issue?" He described it over the phone. My jaw kind of dropped. He sent some documents in the mail. We put him in touch with a few other people, which led to Mr. Crosby from upstate New York. And Mr. Crosby, thank you for coming here and spending this evening and these few days here in Chicago. We've had you on the Internet shortwave radio along with satellite programming a couple of times this week. Hope to get him on the blogs, hope to get him all over the world, because this story is got to be broken open. It's almost like I'm witnessing something, a bank robbery. Mr. Crosby, you took litigation all the way to the Supreme Court after you were tipped off to something that caught your eye from Walter Cronkite's comments on the TV one year. Take us back to 1974 and what caught your eye and what brought you to this day, to this saga in the very beginning.
Thank you for having me here, Fred. Good evening, veterans. In 1974, March, I'm sure other veterans saw this on CBS Evening News, Walter Cronkite. There was a very short and quick story. And Mr. Cronkite said that today the Department of Defense said it would stop putting secret coded numbers called spin codes on a veteran's discharge paper, the DD-214. And only a couple hundred thousand veterans had these numbers, and it was those with bad conduct and dishonorable discharges. Well, quite naturally, I thought to myself when I heard that, I go, phew, that's not me. I have an honorable discharge. So, what happened from that result was, at that time, I was working at Griffiss Air Force Base, Rome, New York, as a civilian worker, as a temporary winter hire, they call them there. And I had taken a U.S. Civil Service exam. My name was number one on the list, and when springtime came, they were going to hire three people permanently. They always hire you for 6 months first to see if you're a good worker or whatever. And when they did the hiring, they hired number 9, number 11, and number 14. And I thought to myself, this isn't right. If your name's number one on a list and you're the smartest one, why are they hiring people with less qualifications? So I started to dig into this to find out why. And, of course, the only thing I could do at that time was file an equal employment opportunity complaint. And I had to base it on religion. So at least we had some investigation. And by December of 75, their decision came down and said, based on religion, you don't win. And so my attorney, I had an attorney from the Legal Services Corporation in Syracuse, New York, and he filed immediately in January of 76 a complaint in federal court about this, because based on what we heard from testimony, something was very, very wrong. And then I got to thinking, well, maybe I better ask if I have one of these secret numbers. So, and I'll never forget that day, February 2nd, 1976, that's Groundhog Day. There was a blizzard going outside up in the Tug Hill Plateau area in New York. And I called the American Friends Service Committee in Syracuse, New York, who are Quaker people. And I asked them, do you know anything about these code numbers? And they said, well, yes, we do. We have a list of them right here. And they told me where to look on my DD-214 to find this. And I said, here's what it says. And they said, well, yours says unsatisfactory handling of personal affairs. And I go, what? And so I went and called my attorney right away. And within a few weeks, March of 1976, we had amended our complaint in federal court to say that I had lost this job because of this secret code number. And had I waited until June of 76, there was a five-year statute of limitations from the date a veteran gets out of the military, 5 years, and when that ends, you can't go back and do anything. You have that time to correct a record, to ask, to take care of an injustice or whatever.
From 71 to 76.
76. Okay. So I got this in within 3 months of it being the end of the time. So I was very lucky. And the fact that I had found out I had one of these. So that started this odyssey from March of 1976 up until now that we're still fighting this thing. And I go back into court occasionally. I reopened this again in 1986 and again in 2001 and brought evidence to the court that the government attorneys had committed all these criminal acts. So this has been an ongoing battle. And it's very frustrating when you have all the proof and all the evidence to be told through some legal phrase or whatever, or a criminal act committed by a U.S. attorney, you can't come in the door. And that's just very, very strange.
Now, Edwin, we have here the DD-214. Could you hold that up to the camera? This is the discharge papers that a veteran has upon discharge from the service.
That's correct, Fred. When a veteran leaves the military, every veteran is given this document. The DD stands for Department of Defense Form 214, and every veteran knows what it is because the VA asked for it, employers asked for it. I mean, this is what the federal courts have determined to be our passport to civil life. And if you'll look right here on this particular line, I can see it on the back. Yep. It says SPN 411.
SPN 411.
That stands for Separation Program Number, and that is the secret code numbers that we're talking about. If you were in the Army, yours said Separation Program Number. If you're in the Navy or the Air Force, it said Separation Designator Number, SDN. Then it would, of course, have three numbers. And these code numbers can say bedwetter, homosexual, paranoid schizoid, repeated VD, lewd acts, character and behavior disorders, unsanitary habits, pregnancy. They go on and on, but before that phrase comes up, there are key words, and on Plaintiff's Exhibit 2, which I believe they have a good copy of and can show on the TV, it says that they will not state in words these particular things: unsuitability, inaptitude, unfitness, misconduct, homosexual, or any reason based on mental or moral issues. And this original document, Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 2, this is the original court seal down at the bottom that the court put there, is dated June of 1956. So that's when these code numbers were ordered by the Department of Defense. The DOD ordered the military people to begin placing this upon discharge. But what happened, I believe, and what we've seen from all these documents, that by the 1960s, there was rampant abuse of these code numbers where they were giving them out like candy. And even though you may have had, for instance, a Sergeant Roy Benvenides, the Medal of Honor winner from Vietnam, was stabbed in the back with one of these code numbers. And it didn't make any difference if you had medals on your chest or an honorable discharge or you served your country good. You were given one of these code numbers, And as later we get into discussion, those watching will understand and learn why we were given these numbers to blacklist us from job, bank loans, life insurance, and benefits, that it was being used to rip off massive amounts of money never before seen in this in our nation of a bunch of thieves stealing billions.
Dr. Lee Warren.
Well, I want to say...
You're a Vietnam vet.
I'm a Vietnam vet. I want to back this up some. I was in the Navy. Now, when you speak of this code, SPN number, so then if you got an honorable discharge, which most employees would ask, then there was a something that was, this code was above that that would affect that honorable discharge. Am I right?
That's correct. And an employer didn't even care about the word honorable. They have gave testimony, or we have it documented, that all they wanted to see was this code number. That's it, because that is considered to be the reason for discharge. So if you went in and had an honorable discharge and they saw all these medals and you were proud of your service to your country, they didn't give a hoot. They just looked at that number. That's what they wanted to see.
Wait a minute. We got to back up here. Now, if you got an honorable discharge, then that, according to laws of Congress, there were certain benefits that was given to veterans. Say the GI Bill or et cetera. So you're saying then, how does that code affect those benefits, if at all?
This particular code number that we're talking about, the SPIN code, if you have an honorable discharge, yes, you're entitled to veterans benefits.
The college benefits and
college benefits and hospital.
Mortgage and all of that. And the veterans at hospital and stuff.
Right. And an under honorable discharge for the same thing, that you would be entitled to everything. However,
okay, that is beyond that.
Beyond that. But when, in the civilian sector, these code numbers were used to give you employment or life insurance. And you can't have a bank loan without life insurance. So veterans were blacklisted from those things. But when you got to the Veterans Administration and you went in to have medical treatment done and you had one of these bad code numbers, you went down to the bottom of the list. Or you were given and told, we'll come back in a year. It'll take a year to set up an appointment for you. So you were delayed, and during that time, just this past week, a new study done by the Veterans Administration said that it takes about 30 days for a veteran just to get to see a doctor, and then up to a year for him to see the specialist. 20% die before they even get to see the specialist. That's 2 out of 10. Die before they can even get to see a specialist. So something is very wrong, but what we discovered with these codes through this litigation and years of legal research is that they're doing something with these code numbers, and Fred will lead us there in a few moments so the veterans and people watching the show can understand how this simple little thing, and it seems quite simple, that they were able to do that.
I would like for the listeners to get some visuals here so they can appreciate what's really going on. This is not an old problem. This is going on today.
That's correct.
It's systemic fraud. It's going on today. There are people, and the magnitude of the amount of this could be on upwards of $400 to $500 million a month.
A month.
A month. Going on for 40 plus 50 years. The documentation on this is so incredible. I have in front of me here letters. Goodyear Tire and Rubber is in receipt of these codes. Has your company been supplied a list to interpret discharge code numbers? Yes. Goodyear Tire and Rubber says yes. Headquarters of, this is, who is this here?
Boeing.
Boeing. Now in Chicago. Has your company been supplied a list to interpret the code discharge numbers? Yes. Boeing admits yes. Honeywell. Has your company been provided a list to interpret the discharge code numbers? Yes. Honeywell. So these codes, like a virus, like a cancer, have been distributed all over corporate America, correct?
That is correct.
Through the VA.
Through the VA and through...
And now they can say, we didn't do anything. Look at the VA. And the VA says... We didn't do anything, Department of Defense. It's a three-card Monte.
Yeah.
Okay, but the codes are you go to apply for a job at Goodyear, you are Edwin Crosby, and they want to see on your DD-214 is your SPN code number.
That's correct.
And if you don't have a good code number, you can interview all you want, but you're never going to get a job there, right?
That's correct. You're going to be.
You can have the highest accolades in terms of electromechanical engineering, schooling, experience in war, doing whatever, and you're not going to get a job at any one of these major corporations.
That's correct, and that's why Vietnam veterans lead the nation in homelessness, underemployment, unemployment, and all these things, because you have to look at the time period. During the 1960s, the government got its computers in 1964, and that's when they had this race to start identifying and giving everybody these coded numbers, and especially during the period of the Vietnam War, these men coming back from Vietnam, from what we've been able to ascertain visually by looking and interviewing a lot of Vietnam veterans, 8 out of 10 of them would have a derogatory code number.
So what this does, it's like fraud, basically, because they're telling you, on one hand, it's like a university giving you a diploma. And then at the same time you earn your diploma, that is something derogatory, just about disannuls the diploma.
Yeah.
So they're telling you got honorable the discharge, yeah, but yet they got a code that says, well, you this type of personality, which really disannuls the whole thing. So
exactly.
You might as well just have dishonorable discharge there.
Exactly. And nobody told you about these codes? Veterans about these codes,
right?
No,
the regulations say that a veteran will not be told about this. And now how this came about, so the public started to understand, was Senator Sam Ervin of the Watergate Committee started to investigate where the committee to reelect the president, it was called CREEP, was getting all those tens of millions of dollars from. That's how these code numbers popped up.
And during that investigation of Watergate.
During that investigation of Watergate, and they didn't understand what they had. Nobody bothered to look, but there was great discussion in congressional
72,
records.
72, 73, 74.
73, 74, 75 is
okay.
When you see congressional records from that period, from the Senate and the House, discussing this issue, and that they were satisfied when DOD testified before Congress and said, hey, we'll stop it. We'll stop the SPN code system. Well, what they did, they were already going to rename it SPD, Separation Program Designator, so they more or less perjured themselves before Congress by just changing the name, which I give as example is a judge says to a Chevrolet dealer, I'm giving you tomorrow to get rid of all them Chevrolets. And when the judge comes back, he goes, well, these are the same cars that were here yesterday. And they go, oh, no, they're not. Look, we took that Chevy logo off and we stuck a Buick logo on there. They're now Buicks. But to you and me and the doctor over here, it's the same car. That black car that was there yesterday never moved. And it says Body by Fisher on it and everything else. It's the same one. So what they did is they thought it was a joke, a legalese trick.
Okay, now let's get into the real meat and potatoes here. Why are they doing this? Describe systematically what would happen when you as a veteran would go to apply for your benefits and be declined. You would have a veteran claim number, right? They would decline you, but they would look at your code and they would insert a bogus name with your claim number, correct?
That's
and the money would flow to this bogus name.
That's correct. Every veteran knows what their VA claim number is. When you go to the VA hospital or even file for service-connected benefits, you can be asked for that number. A lot of times now they're just asking for the last four of your Social Security, but in order to make sure they have the right person, they ask about your VA claim number. And what they did, the computer logic of the VA's computer systems is looking for this code number. It's required in the computer logic to determine basic eligibility for benefits.
Uh-huh.
So if you submit for a benefit, the computer looks at it and it sends a letter to the real veteran. Dear veteran, we're terribly sorry, but you're not entitled to that benefit. And the veteran will probably go, oh, well, that's the way that goes. But out of 10 veterans, two or three of them will come back and say, yes, I am. But in the meantime, they've got that veteran's VA claim number, and it's now in the system. So when a veteran submits for benefits for service-connected disability, they're taking that VA claim number and giving it a phony name. and are a ghost name. And this phony is getting the money, and the real veteran, I happen to have been one who had my claim in for more than 20 years, and there's 400,000 claims backlog now of veterans. These people aren't getting paid, and there's a reason for it, and it's this ripoff of these funds. And if
somebody's getting this money, though.
No, wait a minute. Yes. We've got to back up here. Are you saying that this is like identity theft? This, you have the real person, then they set up a fraudulent account with your claim number, and so you basically denied benefits, yet they're paid benefits to this ghost person.
That's correct. That's what they're doing. And say, for instance, if you're that veteran, I just keep telling you, and I'm the VA, denied. You don't have enough medical items. Denied, denied. And I'm slipping the money month to month over here to this individual. One person can have 10 different phony names, can go to 10 different banks on the first of the month, and he's known by a different name at every bank, and pick up this money, because they're all electronically deposited now, as you're aware.
Right.
But what also, so the viewers can say, well, wait a minute, I don't know about that. Recently, everybody's aware that there were three lawyers who were arrested and prosecuted at the general counsel's office at the VA in Washington, D.C., for destroying medical evidence in veterans' claims file folders. The one lawyer said he did more than 100,000. The female lawyer, Jill Rigolowski, said she did thousands. So if you take that and say, wait a minute, why did they take medical evidence out and throw it in a trash can and then tell a veteran, claim denied, because you made it to the Board of Veterans' Appeals or the Court of Veterans' Appeals, they took the evidence out and destroyed it. Why wouldn't they want to pay these 100, 150,000 veterans their claims? Because alarm bells would go off in the system if they awarded veterans benefits to the real veteran. Somebody's going to say, well, we've been paying that man for 20 years. What's he asking about this for? And Mr. Smart heard a gentleman on the telephone today doing a radio show talk about the Danville VA and how these checks were done.
Wait a minute.
The Danville Alan chimed in. He called the Danville VA, and they admitted that these veterans had been receiving benefits for 10 years. And the veteran said, "Wait a minute, we haven't received any benefits. So for 10 years, money was going out in the name of these on the claim number of these veterans to bogus accounts. Correct?
Yeah. A lady came in with a cart and said, "I'm here to give you your checks." And they go. The veteran said, "What?" And he said, she said, "Well, you're so-and-so, aren't you? You've been here 10 years collecting money." And they go, "Well, I know we haven't." And they called the sheriff and the police. And as Fred said, in fact, they discovered a box, a great big huge box, in the director's office of checks made out to these phonies. So in that particular box, there was obviously millions of dollars. So that was just one place. Now, this isn't going on in every place in America, but it's going on and enough of these regional offices in particular states where there's heavy veteran population and where they can draw this money out. And I believe we talked before about this. New York, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Texas, California, Florida, and maybe another one has an awful large veteran population. So if there's regional offices for veterans benefits in that particular state, like Buffalo, New York, I believe that that's what they're doing in this regional office in Buffalo, and why veterans aren't, when they have all the medical evidence they need to be paid, that they've been waiting 10, 15, 20 years to be paid, is they can't do it because the veteran has been getting paid under that legal claim number. But the legal veteran, the real live veteran, say for instance you, isn't getting the money.
Wait a minute. Where is the oversight here? See, I work.
There's no oversight.
You got to have somebody to come in, a CPA, or somebody to come in and look at them books and find out. In fact, I work for insurance companies, and they would have to verify those claims. They would tell our people and say, okay, you statistically, you know, how much fraud is, you know, verify and cross verify. So if they would go and try to find out, you know, say statistically, if I came in to be a consultant to verify that those checks was getting to where they were supposed to go, this thing, he would blow sky high.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to close out segment one, talking about blowing it sky high. A simple way to do this, you came up with this idea. which would be to reissue new claim numbers to all veterans, and then you'd find out who really is real, who's not real.
Who's alive and who's dead.
Okay. Okay. In the next segment, we're going to end segment one here. We're going to get into a lot of the heavy lifting of what you went through to apply the research, to apply the case through the judicial system all the way to the Supreme Court. Some stories about you meeting some top senators, some top congressmen who you know categorically knew the fraud. And a snapshot of Senator McCain, who used to be in the military wearing his white duds. You faced him down, and he knew, he saw it, along with Senator Biden, to this day.
That's correct.
You can tell the story next segment. This is incredible. This, in a state that was the last among 50 states, we're breaking this story open, thanks to Ed Crosby from New York. And, my gosh, I don't know what more I could say, but next segment we're going to get into more details. If you're listening, please join us for the next segment of Veterans Forum. I'm Fred Smart, along with Dr. Lee Warren. Thank you very much. And with Ed Crosby. Thank you very much. We're back for our second edition with Veterans Forum, with our special guest from all the way from Albion, New York, Edwin Crosby III, my co-host, Dr. Lee Warren. We covered the first segment of this saga, this odyssey that Mr. Crosby first encountered in 1974 when he was listening to Walter Cronkite comment on how hundreds of thousands of codes would be relabeled because of a problem within the Veteran Foreign Affairs or Veteran Affairs Association for Benefits. This caught his attention. He was discharged honorably from the military and went to seek his first job. He knew that he rated top of the list in terms of his testing, could not get the job. It brought him down to research this. Mr. Crosby has taken litigation to the Supreme Court regarding, quote, secret coded numbers placed upon main employment reference document of all 26 million American veterans. This is a document called the DD-214 form. Twice he has tried to reopen this litigation, once in 96 and again in 2001. Records show the government's lawyers committing criminal acts to prevent this case from being heard. In our last segment, we talked about the general overview of this fraud, how these codes are being administered, shared among corporations all over America. Corporations are getting lists of these codes that basically, despite the fact that a veteran is discharged honorably, can have all of the badges on his chest, when he goes to get a job or goes to get benefits, if they have a bad code and it's in the system, the employer, the Veteran Affairs Association, looks at the code, nothing to do with his record. And if he's got a bad number, he can't get benefits. If he's got a bad number, he can't get a job. But here's the worst of it. The money still flows, but it doesn't go to the veteran. It goes to secret accounts. So somebody is taking this money. This is organized crime. And we're here to discuss the saga, Ed, of your litigation journey that started in 1974, and you discovered this February 2nd of 76. Take us through the first part of this litigation journey, and which brings us all the way to 2001, where you tried to reopen this case. And I'm blown away that a huge 5-inch thick transcript was destroyed by the government. And you don't have a copy of this, but you've got all of this other evidence, all of this other paperwork. But by God, take us back to the beginning. Let's walk through this.
Thank you. In March of 1976, as I said earlier, we had amended our claim. So we had from March of 76 till September 1978 to do research and to investigate and to dig up all the information we could. And I became quite the expert in the Freedom of Information and Privacy Act request, and I was submitting many of them. And I was making trips to Washington, D.C., and walking the halls of Congress, and there were certain congressmen who were and senators who were involved in investigating or looked into this matter. Senator McGovern, at that time Congressman Les Aspin, Congressman Koch, Congressman Seiberling, were some who had information, and I went to their offices and would dig up this stuff. And of course, plaintiff's exhibit number 12, which I'm holding now, is a congressional record from April of 1977, and this gave a very good account of what was going on. In fact, the congressman said, "It is my belief that these veterans have been done a great injustice by the armed forces and by society." Now, by September 78, we were ready to go to court, and we had all the proof, and we arrived in Auburn, New York, and the federal judge, Edmund Port, was the oldest federal judge in the country, I believe, at that time, and we had 2 days of testimony, and the government's witness, in fact, was rather unique. Her name was June Hughes, from Randolph Air Force Base in Texas. And she's the lady who dreamed up this whole secret thing. And what was interesting about that was a couple years later in Washington, D.C., I'm before the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, sitting down with these people going over this, and everybody introduced themselves around the table, and there was a lady sitting over here, and she said, "My name is Ann Hughes." And the next person went, and the next one, and I said, "Excuse me, just a moment." And I looked back over and I said, "What did you say your name was?" And she said, "Ann Hughes." And I said, "You're any relation to June Hughes?" And she turned beet red, grabbed her paperwork, got up and walked out. And that was the last they saw of her. So there's another Hughes. But going back to that September of 78 deal, I got on the witness stand. I gave testimony. In fact, the judge said, my attorney asked the question, "Mr. Crosby, were you in Vietnam?" And the government's lawyers objected. And the judge said, "Why?" And it came out that I was in this top secret special operations outfit in Vietnam. And the judge said, "Are these black airplanes with no star or tail number we all heard about but know nothing about?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "We're going to hear this." So in 1978, we were able to get this testimony in about things that the American people didn't know about, but the strange thing, there was only one news reporter in the courtroom that day when everybody in New York City was notified and all the major networks were notified. Nobody wanted to come. And when during that period of time, we had 19 exhibits to submit to the court. Plaintiff's Exhibit 19 was the infamous corporation questionnaire, which came to me, and which
is document number 2,
and which Fred held up the corporation things.
Exhibit 19A.
No, the
okay.
Yes.
Oh,
there you go. The Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company.
Goodyear Tire and Rubber. Got it. Yeah.
And that came to us in 86.
I think we have. I'm sorry, not Goodyear Tire. We have Honeywell up there.
Honeywell.
Yeah, Honeywell.
So you had all these major corporations and banks and life insurance companies had these code numbers. And they did not want that in. And we had quite the argument over getting this plaintiff's Exhibit 19 in this corporation questionnaire, because you can think about this. We're talking the major corporations in America, and if you're talking Honeywell or Boeing or Goodyear, they own literally hundreds of companies. They're called subsidiaries. And if the big up at the top has it, then you know all the rest of them do too. And a company like Boeing probably has 400 or 500 companies, because in every state they manufacture a part for an airplane, and it's all shipped to Seattle on a planes bill. So we had a heck of a time getting all these particular documents in, and we had Department of Defense directives and instructions and things people never saw before, including two very important pieces of evidence were the staff studies done by the Secretary of Defense. Even on one document we have written on the side is Nixon's White House counsel, J. Fred Buzhardt, and he's concurring with their opinion on what to do or not to do about these code numbers. And it really gets interesting. So and one piece of evidence that we did not get but came later, because if you'll look at the date, is that October 30, an October 30th, 1979 document.
Exhibit 19A.
19A, yep. Which, of course, I said we were in court in September of 78.
Uh-huh.
So we did not get to introduce this at that time. Finally, our two-day trial was done in September of 78, and in January of 79, Judge Edmund Port issued his decision. And he said, because I have issued a federal court order and the government stated for the record that they corrected your records, nobody will ever see this secret number, trust us, we did it, then the judge said, you have no subject matter jurisdiction because they have corrected the problem, you have no claim. So we knew that they couldn't correct the records because it's like the little boy sticking his finger in the dam, that the leak's going to get bigger over there, but these code numbers have been disseminated through computer systems, and a lot of people just didn't understand in the late 70s how at the snap of a fingers you can send information from Washington, D.C. to California, mm-hmm. at the snap of a fingers, and they didn't understand what was going on. So a year goes by, and we draw up our submission to the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York City. We're now appealing the judge's decision, and we're trying to get our argument across to them, and we actually went there September of 79. Now, once again, I'm going to point out this letter is dated 30 October 79. Mm-hmm. This information that's in this very, very important letter was requested a year or two before we even got it. And notice how they held it up.
Exhibit 19 again.
Exhibit 19.
And this is on the second page. It says, the number of such individuals affected as of 1977 approached 20 million.
That's correct.
Now, and when you first were digging, the only numbers you had was like 100,000 to 200,000 in the public domain.
Right. What Walter Cronkite said, that the Department of Defense testified to Congress, only a couple hundred thousand have these code numbers. And then, is after our case.
So they withheld this evidence all the way through your case. Now you're on appeal, and they dragged it all the way out before they finally gave this up.
That's right. After we got done with the Second Circuit, then the letter comes to us at the end of October 79, a month too late.
Wow.
And had we this document, we could have shown it to them and said, look, this proves perjury by the Department of Defense, but here on the front of the document is something very important. It says, copies are furnished to the Veterans Administration for determining basic eligibility for veterans benefits. And then it goes on to say, down at the bottom, under the Privacy Protection mm-hmm. Study Commission report, their recommendation to Congress was, look, members of Congress, this is what you need to do. Issue new DD-214s to all dischargees whose forms currently include SPID numbers. And as Mr. Smart has over here on page 2, it says 20 million. So we knew that they were going to have to give 20 million veterans a new discharge paper. Well, immediately somebody goes, well, that's going to cost us too much. And I believe on that piece of paper it says $100 per separatee, how they have it worded.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that is
25 million. Right,
that's
up the top.
Washington speak.
Administratively. Yeah, 1 to 2 billion.
Yeah, that's Washington political speak. What should have been said in black and white on his letter, oh my goodness, if we tell 20 million veterans we've given them these secret numbers and a couple million of them have bad code numbers and these are our combat veterans and our brave men, our next generation of leaders that we stabbed them in the back, oh boy, we're going to be in big trouble and we're going to get voted out of office. And then we're going to go find out, because it would have, through process of elimination, would have been brought forth is, hey, wait a minute, who's been taking all this money? And that's why the Veterans Administration to this day is in dire straits. So the case proceeded to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court of the United States said certiorari denied. They didn't want to hear it. And I had judges and friends, law professors say, don't give up. With time, things change. People die. They move out of office. Keep trying. All you have to do is prove to the court that they lied and that you did find that number's out there and is being used against you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it didn't take very long because when people lie, they're going to get tripped up. And I was working for the chief administrative law judge of the state of Delaware. and I was able to get into all the unemployment records of veterans and talk to them as they came in, and I was doing my own studies. But one day I was told to go over to the federal building to this big veterans meeting. And there was veterans from the American Legion, VFW, all the veterans organizations, and even some other ones that I didn't even hear of or know about, and some other poopahs were over there. And Senator Joseph Biden from Delaware came walking in, and there was a gentleman accompanying him in a naval uniform, white uniform, and a captain. And that's all I could tell at that point, because for a lot of people, naval rank's a little bit difficult. Captain's bars mean colonel, I think, in the Navy, but in the Air Force, two bars is a captain, in the Army, same. But there he was, and we all had this discussion, and it came my turn, and I stood up and told him about these documents and the court case and how all this money's being getting ripped off. And he said, "Let's wait until the end of this," Senator Biden said. And when everybody left, we went into a room with a table and chairs, and sat down, and I showed him all these documents.
You were with Senator Biden.
Senator Biden.
And this gentleman dressed in white, who was?
Who was, and at that, as we sat down at that table, and I looked over, and of course, he introduced him, but I saw the name tag. There sits John McCain.
John McCain. The John McCain.
Now United States Senator. And as one Vietnam veteran to another, I said to him, "You need to really look at this." And I showed it to him.
What year, what date, what month? What?
This was approximately 1983. I have a letter in my briefcase over here that shows my letter of introduction from the judge in Delaware, so I can pinpoint the exact month of it. But it was about 1983. And I looked over and said, "You're a brother veteran. You need to know about this," and I showed it to him, and he got it all. And
how long was the meeting? How long did it take for you to kind of lay out the basics?
We were there probably about an hour.
Okay.
So everybody, they understood.
How many people were in the room?
Just the three of us: Senator Biden, John McCain, and myself.
Oh my God!
And we left the meeting, and the senator said he would look into this matter. Well, as time told, John McCain went back to Arizona and became a congressman. Then he became a United States Senator, but to this day, not ever has he tried to introduce a bill or do anything to bring this to light to veterans. And I confronted him, went to his office in Washington, D.C. to confront him about it, and to more or less say to him, "Listen, you owe me one, you owe your brother veterans one." And when he saw me, he ran out the side door and ran down the hallway.
You were walking into his office, you were describing his office as a long one?
Yes.
And he was at the end?
Yeah, he
and
was
he
at
saw
the end.
You?
He saw me back there and opened the side door to the office, which they can get out into the hallway, and boom, down the hallway,
and
he went
left.
Running. And that was my opinion, and I posted this up on the Internet before so people can understand it, that when somebody does that, would sell their brother veterans down the drain, that kind of a person we don't need. And I would dare this individual to come and debate me on that particular subject on that day when we were there, and he heard it all, and he has done nothing. So
let me just segue with Dr. Warren here. Doctor, today we were on a radio/internet shortwave show. A gentleman, Alan from Illinois, discovered all of this on his own, almost like...
Independent of him.
Had never met him. And we put him in touch with each other and other people around the country who have kind of this mosaic of people. It's not just, you know, there's probably a community of people that could have a big convention and discuss this in detail. We're discussing the fact that this has been going on for a long time. And what is it going to, I mean, walk us through, but he has submitted to Obama and Durbin. Durbin, 5 weeks ago.
Yes.
The latest. And Durbin, within 3 days, sent him a letter saying, "We are looking into this." So I just want the listening audience here on this program to know Senator Durbin is in receipt of a good chunk of this information. And he has stated that he is looking into this. I believe he sent information like this to Obama last year or whenever, and he didn't get the response that he's getting from Durbin. But proceed. Go ahead.
After this, my period of time working at in Delaware, I came back up to New York, and I got a job working at a hospital in Syracuse, New York, as a temporary, with a temporary services as a hospital admissions clerk. And I worked for about 4 months, and they said, well, you're real good. You haven't missed any work. Why don't you go take a New York State civil service exam, and we'll hire you. So I went down to take the exam, and I sat in a chair, and the man brought in a piece of scratch paper and a pen, and he did it to four other people sitting there. I don't know if they were taking the same test. And then he came in, and he handed each one a test, and he came over to me and picked up my paper and picked up my pencil, and he walked out and didn't say anything. And the other people are looking at me like, what's
going
on?
Wait a minute, you hadn't finished, or?
No, he gave me nothing. Took it away from me.
Oh, my God.
And so I got up and followed him out, and I said, what's going on here? And he said, I can't let you take the test. And I said, I beg your pardon? And he said, you can't take the test. And I said, well, listen, you better tell me why, or I'm going to make a few phone calls, and you're going to be arrested for obstructing governmental administration. So he took me over, and he said, give me your Social Security number again. And he punched my Social Security number in the state's computer, and up came my military records, which they're not supposed to have. And he said, right there, see that? And he pointed to my secret code number, the one that the court said would never show up again. Judge, we fixed his records. Believe us.
And this is how many years later?
We're the U.S. Attorney's Office. We don't tell lies. And, of course, we knew they were lying, but you got to catch them at it. So there it was, right there on this TV screen and the computer screen. And he said, we can't let you take the test.
Why? Because of that code.
Because of that code.
He wouldn't tell you why.
Because of that spin code.
But is there any specific law that states that you are barred from taking that code?
No. That was the strange thing, because anybody, if I'm a resident of New York State and I want to take a New York State civil service exam, of course I'm allowed to do it. And they had no legal reason to do that other than what he was told. His supervisor told him, if any of these veterans have any of these kind of secret codes, and he had the list of them in his desk drawer.
Again, it goes back to these Honeywell letters, the Boeing letters, the Goodyear tire and rubber letter. All of these corporations have received these codes on tens of millions of American veterans.
Well, it's a form of discrimination. That's what it comes down to.
Yes, you have it exactly. And it is sort of a civil rights violation.
Right.
But what we were trying to say, and what we did in our argument to the court was, and what my attorney thought, is this is a foreclosure of the employment market. They just said to us veterans, when we got out of the military, it's like putting this big old label on your forehead, do not hire.
Yeah, you got a mark.
And that was it. You were done.
It's like putting a bag over your head.
Well, you were.
Saying, do not hire, unemployable, uninsurable, whatever.
Right, and as you
walk
by,
you're a felon then.
Yeah, that's right. You're worse than a felon, and you didn't commit an act. You didn't commit a criminal act.
Right.
And that's the funny thing about it, that nobody committed a crime. You were never tried for anything. You were never accused of anything. Just somebody who decided, I'll give him this one. And they gave him out like that. Now, when you go back to the particular point of this court case, when in 83, something else happened here. After the McCain incident, I went and did this thing with the New York State Department of Labor, and of course he told me, you can't get it. I walked right over to the judge who was my mentor and friend, the chief judge of Syracuse, New York, was Joseph Falco. He's now deceased. And he said, Edwin, what you need to do is get this immediately over to the grand jury. And he said, I'm going to tell you a little trick. And he said, don't address it to the U.S. attorney. Address it to Foreman, U.S. Federal Grand Jury, send it certified mail, no green return receipt card. Therefore, the secrecy of the grand jury is protected, and when they get it over at the court clerk's office, they must deliver it to the foreman of the grand jury. It's an old trick, he goes, a lawyer's trick. So I did it, and about a month later, I received a letter, and that letter said, come on over to the grand jury and testify. And I went in April of 1983 and testified before a United States federal grand jury, showed them all these documents, showed them the court order, how the government's attorneys lied, pointing to the one at a U.S. attorney over there and said, that person is a criminal and a liar.
Oh, he was in the room?
Yes. And
why was he in the room?
Because he was entitled as the United States attorney, assistant United States attorney. They're allowed to be present during the grand jury. And I gave this evidence, and I said, you citizens need to indict that man over at the unemployment office, because I filed criminal charges against him, and indict his supervisor and his, and all the way right to Albany, New York, and to the governor. And what they did is indict, though we never saw the indictment, never heard about it, that they voted that day to indict. The governor of New York at that time was Mario Cuomo, and all these people from the Department of Labor right down the line, for systematically eliminating the veterans of the state of New York and for crimes against humanity. Now, why those two things? We learn from history. History repeats itself. We're talking about branding human beings with a number to systematically eliminate them. Where did we hear that before?
Nazi Germany.
That was in a place called Nazi Germany when they tattooed a number on somebody. But guess what? This is the computer age, folks. You don't need a tattoo artist. All you have to do is give them a Social Security number, and right next to it, you stick one of these code numbers, and goodbye. That's it. Show's over.
So they wash their hands of it. Nobody needs to be guilty. It's just
right.
It's will the wisp in the computer.
You got it. It's gone. It's out there in electronic land.
Pandora's box. The flies have left Pandora's box.
That's right. The Pandora's box has been opened. But legally, under the law, we have something called the Constitution of the United States, which says we're entitled to due process of law. And if all these guys given these secret numbers were never given their due process of law, somebody is responsible. And somebody should be paying for this great injustice.
Section 3, we're going to concentrate. How do we solve this? Who's responsible? And who's going to pay for this? And we're going to talk about the judicial system. We're going to talk about Congress. We're going to talk about the judges. We're going to talk about all the attorneys and the bar associations. Because you went all across the country and approached the bar associations on a state-by-state-by-state basis. Ed Crosby, the saga continues with a systematic fraud against veterans here in this country. Thank you, along with Dr. Warren. We're back. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This is our third show covering the saga of Edwin Crosby III from Albion, New York, a gentleman who many, many years ago discovered quite by accident a systemic, computerized, almost like a cancerous internal virus inside the veterans system that is systematically depriving veterans of their benefits, of even jobs. It has wreaked havoc on the lives of millions of veterans. As we all know, Vietnam veterans have ranked very high nationally on abuse of drugs, being homeless, being poor, on and on down the line. And we're finding with Ed's research, he has uncovered not just like opening Pandora's box, but he has actually searched in research over the last 20, 30 years and pretty much documented all the flies that left Pandora's box. So fortunately, we have people like Ed who are very, very diligent in how they approach due process from their perspective. Because, Ed, thanks for coming back for our third segment. You have been guided for 25, 30 years, all the way back to 1974. This is 33 years. What keeps you going here? You aren't doing this for yourself. You're doing this for other veterans. You're doing this for what it means to be an American. You fought in Vietnam so that we could have due process here at home, so we could have a judicial system that does operate according to the rule of law. And you have been denied systematically due process. You have a mountain of evidence. Many top senators and congressmen are aware of this. We've gotten calls from around the country that people, veterans, have done their own research. Here in Illinois, Illinois ranked dead last in terms of veteran benefits. We're here with our guest co-host, Dr. Lee Warren. We've sat here, Lee, for last hour and a half. And I'd like to lead off with a feather in Ed Crosby's hat. You reached all the way to the Supreme Court, and only 393 of these orders were passed out by the Supreme Court in the first 191 years of our country's history, going back to 1789 with the ratification of the Constitution. Tell me how special this court order from the Supreme Court is and what it meant to your mentor, your judge friend in New York.
Back when our case was supposed to go to the Supreme Court, I received a letter at 1 o'clock in the afternoon from the court clerk of the Supreme Court of the United States saying I had till 4 o'clock that afternoon to get the documents down there or this case is out, kit and caboodle, boom, gone. And I called up and I said, that's rather unfair. It's now 1:30. How can I get to Washington, D.C., let alone draw up something and get it down there by 4 o'clock? That's wrong. So I was advised to submit some sort of motion down to Justice Thurgood Marshall, whose signature is on this document, and see if that they would agree and give us an additional amount of time. And a couple weeks later, that came.
This is before faxes. How did you get this in before 4 o'clock that day? Right?
Well, I certainly couldn't. They told me to submit it. He would make a note and say, I'm looking for it.
Okay,
They did give us a few days to get the letter down there, so we completed it that day, got a request down to him. And when this came back, I was rather shocked. When I opened it up, this particular, as you see it now, it's in black and white form, but this paper is actually on a blue piece of manila thing, kind of fancy, and folded up in thirds. And I opened it up, and I go, United States order. And I looked at it, and I showed my attorney, and these attorneys at the legal services, they kind of got all excited like little kids in a candy store, and I couldn't quite understand this because I'm a soldier. This is something lawyers really gravitate to, and I took it, went over and showed my mentor, the Chief Judge of Syracuse, and he jumped right up behind his desk and got really excited and took off out the door with it and ran into the other judges' chambers there, and he was showing them, look at this, look at my student. He's got a special order from the Supreme Court, and he was really delighted to see that something like this, and I didn't understand till he came back in. He said, do you know what this means? This is the 393rd special order the court has issued. That isn't from this year. He said, that's from the beginning. And I go, oh, now it gravitated to me. I now understood that I was in pretty good company, that Justice Thurgood Marshall believed we should have the opportunity to get our argument down to him so we could still try to get this case heard. And but we didn't. And then we progress here to 1986. After my appearance before the federal grand jury, I waited, and nothing happened. So I filed all the paperwork again and asked the court to reopen it for this court case for fraud upon the court, which is a very most serious crime. Uh-huh. That means you've lied to a judge, that you're affecting the judge's decision. And all I got out of that was this particular document here in front of me, which is a second federal court order, and this is signed from the U.S. District Court in the Northern District in New York, out of Syracuse, and it's signed by a Howard G. Munson. So here is a second federal court order, And I'd like to tell you folks out there that these federal court orders are about worth as much as a roll of Scott toilet paper. These things mean nothing. If a federal judge issues a court order, that should be it. Pow. But it's not. And if someone doesn't obey the order, then they should be arrested for failing to obey the court order. But nothing gets done. So now we went from 1986 all the way to 2001. And I have the patience to not give up. And I just hung in there because I believe in liberty and justice for all. Those words are the end of the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. Plus, I'm originally from near Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I've been to Carpenter's Hall, that's Independence Hall, and when we stood in line to touch the Liberty Bell, I hugged it, because I'm an American. This is my country, and you don't do this to me by stabbing me in the back and think, ha-ha, I'm going to get away with it. And there's people like me, thank goodness that you have people like me that won't give up and fight for years, because I'm not only fighting for me, I'm fighting for this veteran and other veterans out there, some who don't care, some who wish it would go away or whatever, some who don't have the means to do it. I'm doing the best I can with what I have, which is like nothing. And I've always done this, what I say, with a typewriter, a piece of paper, some envelopes and some stamps, a wing and a prayer. And I finally, when I got to court again in 2001, I was in Billings, Montana. It was September 4th, 2001, and I submitted this to the court again. And this time, thanks to a friend who's in the federal judiciary who looked these over, and he said, Ed, all you need is this document and this document to prove that the government lied
to you.
Because the Air Force actually admitted that we have no proof whatsoever we corrected any of your records for 25 years. So that's fraud upon the court. And I gave that to this judge in Billings, Montana. And the next from 2001, 2002 went by.
Well, that was September 4th. That was September 4th, 1 week before 9/11.
1 week before 9/11. And then we went along through 2001, 2002 of motions back and forth. File this brief, file that brief. And I kept heaping more and more documents upon them other than the two that I submitted. Mm-hmm. I attached this court order from New York and said, here, but we have this proof that this, and I kept shoveling this out.
Are you doing it, or are your lawyer doing it?
No, I was doing this because
personally.
I had no lawyer.
Okay.
And though I tried to get one, and as I traveled around New York State, Missouri, Illinois, Montana, in Oregon, I would call the bar associations in each state and ask for the names of 40 lawyers. That was my limit. I said 40 is enough. And I would call these lawyers that they have records that I called there and asked that I would try to find a lawyer who would help with this. Some of them said, come on in, let me see them. Oh, my God, I don't want to get involved in this. Soon as they'd look at them and start to see what it is and really got a better explanation, they would go, oh, I don't want to get involved. And, of course, me being a combat veteran, I had to say something. I go, well, you fellas chicken here or what? You're supposed to be lawyers. I mean, we're just talking during a legal procedure here. What seems to be the problem? Oh, I don't want to get involved. So I had to do this on my own, and I'm pretty good at it, very good at it. But yet I know when I'm smart enough to know when I need an attorney to help get this thing through. But we never could quite get there. But in 2001, I had this evidence, and the U.S. Attorney's Office called up the Fort Harrison, New York Regional Office of the Veterans Administration and told them to destroy a 536-page legal transcript submitted to any federal court clerk. That's a five-year prison sentence. And they
Who ordered to destroy the transcript?
I believe the United States Attorney's Office in Billings, Montana did this. Because why would somebody in the Veterans Administration just say, oh, I select that file over there, and in that big file box is this big doc. I'm going to pull that out of there and go shred it. Why would they do that? Somebody had to physically call and contact this man in order to tell them to go to that box, to pull that document out, and to shred him. And that was my evidence. On page 63 of this transcript was the very same document the government said would never show up again, and here was the Veterans Administration with that document submitting it to the United States Court of Veterans Appeals in Washington, D.C. What more better thing can you have is a government agency submitting it to a United States federal judge? The evidence doesn't get any better than that. And guess what? The transcript was destroyed. And besides that, the same person at the U.S. Attorney's Office told that person up in Montana, listen, fill out a claim for frostbite on Crosby and stick it in his records. So they did this. The next thing I get a letter from the Veterans Administration, we need more information about your claim for frostbite. And I go, I never opened a claim for frostbite. So through 6 or 7 months writing letters back and forth, I have no idea what you're talking about. Please produce proof of this.
Yeah.
Finally, I filed a complaint with a VA inspector general. And the inspector general came to Montana and investigated this. And what he found out was that this official United States government document that all veterans know about that they have to fill out for service connected, somebody filled it out and then forged my signature on it. And I believe that was done to character assassinate a litigant, because somebody could now, the U.S. attorney could go into the judge and say, look, judge, we got another one of these crazy Vietnam veterans here. Oh, boy, he opened a claim for frostbite. How do you get frostbite in Vietnam? But the other thing that they determined was that somebody did do something funny, because the head guy of that regional office, William Peterson, was now transferred from Fort Harrison, Montana to Kentucky. So they knew something happened, and they figured, I guess if we get rid of him, and sometimes what I lack is the funding to be able to hire, call up in Kentucky, get a lawyer to go over and, yeah, and depose that guy. And I could submit the question to him.
Yeah.
But we know that the evidence was there, and then we finally got a letter from the VA. We've researched and looked through your records, the 536-page legal transcript submitted to any federal court clerk is missing. It's we can't find it. It's
totally
not here.
Gone.
So it's gone. So in most federal courts, when you go back to a judge and say, judge, it would appear that the evidence, who they were the custodians of it, it was in their possession. I didn't have it. They had it. It disappeared. And the judge would immediately award you the benefits or do whatever, because they no longer have the evidence. They destroyed their own evidence.
So to this day, nobody's acted upon that destruction, upon that act, upon any ruling to your benefit since then?
No. And in this court case, I actually submitted a motion to compel. And I wanted to know, did the U.S. attorney call this man up at the Fort Harrison, this William Peterson? What day they did it? I want to see all the U.S. attorney's notes, because they must have, because this guy in Fort Harrison, Montana, sent a statement, an affidavit down, and had it put in the records as though he were some sort of expert on these code numbers. Which, after reading his affidavit, if you looked at these documents, you would ascertain that he was wasn't too qualified to even talk about it. But that's what happened, and it was rather unique. Nobody answered my motion to compel. And in this particular, the docket number here, this is the case that went to the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal. You can see the docket numbers from 2002. And there it is, and it went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And in here, I point out to them in my argument, it's my brief, that I submitted this motion to compel to the court, and nobody answered it. And I've been told by judges and other people, law professors, if you submit a motion to compel, the court is compelled to make the other side deliver.
Yeah.
When I submitted it, they never even bothered to answer it. So these are the kind of shenanigans that I've been facing as this just a very corrupt judicial system. And when I look at things with a different eye and I look back at these things and I go, guess what? The Article 3, Section 1 of the Constitution of the United States says, wow, it doesn't say lawyer. It doesn't say attorney. And because I live near Philadelphia, I know this, that there are supposed to be lay people sitting behind a bench. You, me, dressed in a red robe, not a black robe.
Red robe, really?
Red robe, yes. And you know why red? That's red is for the blood that's been shed on the battlefield to defend liberty and justice for all. And there's only one judge in the country right now. In fact, he is a lawyer, but but he wears a red robe. And you don't hear much about him, but he wears a red robe. And when you look at the Constitution, and it doesn't say lawyer or attorney, and it doesn't say bar association, we can clearly state that this bar association and these lawyers have 100% control of our justice system. They have no constitutional authority to be even sitting behind a bench. So what are they doing controlling this? And you, of course, you listen to their excuses.
And I've heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ed, but these bar associations are not registered with any one of the 50 states. These are private associations that aren't registered to receive no licensure from any state. In fact, bar licenses are just simply bar cards coming in a private capacity from the association to the member.
That's a pretty interesting subject in and of itself.
So the state basically has no jurisdiction over these.
That's correct. And it would be easy for us to take back our justice system. But one thing, you spoke about it before, there's a couple ways that we can do something about these secret code numbers.
Yeah.
One way is, I believe, if somebody in Congress got behind it and said, every veteran, go to the nearest VA hospital, give me your name, give me your place of birth, give me your birth date, and give me your thumbprint. And you give me your thumbprint.
Now every veteran that's alive today.
Every veteran who's being paid money.
Who's being paid money.
Or who has...
Right now.
Yes, who's being paid money right now.
Not walk, to your local Veterans Affairs office.
That's what I believe they should do.
And submit what?
Their name.
Name.
Their place of birth.
Place of birth.
Date of birth.
Date of birth.
And their thumbprint.
And their thumbprint.
That's all they need to give. And they need to go to the VA hospital when they do this, not to a regional office or someplace else. They can go to a VA hospital and do it. If they are also have a claim pending with a VA, they should go in but also identify that part. I want people who receive a pension check and a service-connected disability check to go in and give the information and give the thumbprint.
Now.
Yeah, right now.
Put it in now.
And I'll bet you anything, like the doctor over here said about this audit, that when you do this audit...
We're going to audit ourselves.
Yeah, we're going to do this audit. When we do this, that this particular thing is going to come up, and it's going to show, wow, look at all the money going out, but we only have this many people collecting the checks.
That's right.
There's something wrong here.
Let's do it.
Now, the other way to do this, for instance, where this court case is pursuing it from a legal point of view, is I believe... And I'm done a lot of research here and looking, and I'm a thinker, and I thought, listen, there is a way to do this, and that is to sue the American Bar Association for $120 billion as a hate group and terrorist organization. And in my briefcase here, there's a man in Alabama, I've got the paperwork right over there, from the Southern Poverty Law Center. And he makes a living off of going around and suing hate groups around America.
Wow.
And I have the paperwork, so we could sue them as a hate group.
Using
the same guideline to how to do this for genocide and war crimes. And I brought with me, and I have them here. I didn't know we were going to be able to get near. I have those particular sections of law right here. And the one law is very particular. It says that if anybody commits a crime against a veteran in the United States within or without the United States on a war crimes thing, it's 10 years or you can be shot, but the one for genocide, you only get 10 years in jail for carrying out genocide. And that law got snuck by us in Washington. You think about that. They can kill a million people, and all they're going to get is 10 years in jail. I think that's absurd because somebody robs a store and shoots somebody, they get life in prison.
That's right.
Or they get the electric chair.
Right.
So this is a little bit weird that this is going on. But I
want
to
adopt a veteran. Can I adopt you? Can you be my adopted? I'm not a veteran, but I want veterans to get connected. Dr. Warren, I mean, come on. Let's round up all these veterans and let's get them all documented. This is amazing.
Title, U.S. Code, Title 18, Part 1, Chapter 50A, Section 1091.
Okay.
This is genocide. Whoever, whether in time of peace or in time of war, in circumstances described in subsection D. Now, here's the offense is committed within the United States. Now we go back and it says, kills members of that group, causes serious bodily injury to members of that group, subjects the group to conditions of life that are intended to cause the physical destruction of the group in whole or part.
Oh, my God.
Guess what?
We're talking it right here.
Veterans, and this is what the law in America, this is not a foreign law, this is a U.S. law that says that genocide is being carried out right now against the veterans by these documents you see in front of me. Where, oh, where are the lawyers in America who are should be protecting their bar association and their livelihoods should step forward and say, you know, this gentleman's right. He's got all this stuff, and people are being branded with numbers and systematically eliminated. At what point do we stand up and speak out, or the American people are going to have absolutely no faith in our justice system? They're going to start another one. And that might be the only way to go. And we've thought of that, how we can start a new justice system and not get in any trouble about doing it. And we could, but we would prefer to sue them because we believe that money should come in reparations from lawyers whose job it was to protect us. And when the protector doesn't protect, then the protector should pay. It's that person's responsibility. We don't want them to go, well, he did it. We've heard enough of that. It was in your lap. It was on your desk. It was in front of you. And you couldn't make a fair and just decision. You made a decision based on politics, and look what you've done. You've now done. You've outdone Adolf Hitler. Now, you saw the paperwork that said 26 million veterans got these code numbers.
Yes.
One question, and to your viewers. If you have all those documents over there that say the corporations, banks, and life insurance companies,
yeah,
why aren't they using them to give a disgruntled employee or somebody who found out something was going on? They'll say, get rid of that employee. Oh, by the way, give him one of these code numbers. It is my belief that 50 to 70 million civilians have these numbers, too, because the United States Civil Service Commission, the nation's largest employer, gives these code numbers out.
This could be beyond the veterans. We could all be impacted by this.
Oh, sure. Your children, your grandchildren. It touches without you realizing it. And you can go along for years before it really comes up. I mean, there are veterans. Everybody falls through the net. You come home from a war. These Iraqi veterans, they're the same things happen to them. They're going to find out. Now they're finding out how bad the VA is, what you and me knew about, how bad it is. Well, they're not paying me. I lost my leg. It's taken a year, and I still haven't gotten anything. Well, join the club, fellas. We already knew about this, and you didn't pay attention. So, this is such a bad thing because when I sit and look at old movie reels and I go, boy, they really did that in Nazi Germany. They branded people to number and sent them off to these camps and everything and just killed them. And I go, well, by God, they're doing the same thing here in my country.
Well, let me ask you this.
We have 2 minutes. We've got to wrap it up.
The criteria for those numbers, like they said, you was full of apathy. What criteria are they using and how do we have a statistical stratification of from the top to the bottom, where are these people located percentage-wise? I mean, if this is the top 10% got these good codes and 90% bad?
We have to wrap it up. But we could do another show. We will do another show. Hopefully we'll get you back or we'll come to New York and do another show. But this story has to get out there. The veterans deserve better. We all deserve better. We deserve due process of law. We're going to get this on the internet, on the blogs. We're going to put this on Google Video, on YouTube, make the DVDs, pass them out. Thank you. Ed Crosby from New York, you are a true patriot, a true American. Remember, this is 232nd anniversary of the shot heard around the world. Thank you, Ed.
Nice meeting
appreciate
you,
it very
thank
much.
You
thank you, Dr.
Here.
Warren.
Yeah, thank you too.
God bless.
Nice to meet you.